Hello and welcome to the Buyer Insights Podcast, a show about how and why people buy. I'm your host, Liston Witherell, CEO of GoodFunnel, a digital marketing agency. You can check us out on the web at goodfunnel.co. You can listen to all episodes of the Buyer Insights Podcast at goodfunnel.co/podcast, and you can also grab the show notes from this episode there too. Today, I'm really excited to have Susan Weinshank here with me. She is a consultant, a well-known author, a public speaker, and she has a company called The Team W. That's theteamw.com. And she has a variety of courses there, everything from UX certificates to design thinking to how to do customer personas and research your customers. So she has a hugely important base of knowledge about what we talk about here on the show, how and why people buy. And she's also written a variety of books, most recently, How to Get People to Do Stuff, Master the Art and Science of Persuasion and Motivation. And today we cover three of the most important principles that she goes over in her book and how it applies to business. So I think you're going to get a ton out of this, and I'm excited to share my conversation here with Susan. Hi, it's Liston, and I'm here with Susan Weinshank. Susan, how are you today?
I'm doing good.
And did I say your last name correctly?
You did.
Oh, thank goodness. I should have cleared that up in
the
pre-interview. Okay, good. And I'm really excited to have you here today, Susan, because you are someone who focuses aptly. The title of your latest book is called How to Get People to Do Stuff. So you focus on the science of persuasion and how that meets design. If you could, can you take a minute and tell people a little bit about yourself and your business?
Yeah, sure. I have a PhD in psychology, and I love brain science, behavior science, psychology, anything that explains how weird people are and why we do the things we do. And then I love to apply that to what we need to know about people in order to design something that's compelling, in order to get them to take the action that we want them to take. And my business, I've been in consulting and training and public speaking in this field for longer than I am going to admit. So we have a small business and the Team W, and we do a lot of public speaking classes. We have online classes and a little bit of consulting.
Excellent. And my first exposure to you, Susan, was one of your, I don't know how long ago this book was originally published, but 100 Things Every Designer Needs to Know About People.
Yeah.
Which was a fantastic book, by the way.
Thank you.
It up there with Steve Krug's book. Why am I blanking on the title?
Don't Make Me Think.
How ironic. Don't Make Me Think. So yeah, it's an excellent book on understanding what people react to visually and how they process information.
Yeah.
So your latest book, though, How to Get People to Do Stuff, is focused a little bit more on abstract psychological principles. And I was wondering if you could take a minute to talk about what are some of those things that motivate us to actually do something or not do it?
Yeah, well, I broke it down into seven different categories. So there's seven different ways, basically, that you can motivate someone to do something. And then some of those, you know, are appropriate in some situations and others and others. And then there's three of them. And I don't know if you've read the book, but I might give you a quiz here, Liston, and see if you can figure out which three you think are what I call the powerhouses. So there's three of them that I think are really powerful and are the ones that work with most people most of the time. But anyway, just to run through them kind of quickly, and then we can focus in on one or more of them if you want. One of them is the power of stories. And this includes not just the fact that people process information best in story form, which is true, and there's all kinds of fascinating things that happen in the brain when you tell a story, but also the power of self stories, that we have stories that we we tell ourselves and other people about why we do what we do. And those self stories really drive behavior. And there are some very interesting things you can do to change someone's self story, and that will have incredible effect on their behavior. So that's the power of stories. That's number one. Number two is, and these are in no particular order, but number two is rewards. Actually, I call it carrots and sticks, so rewards and punishment, which I think most people are familiar with, you know, the basic idea of using rewards. Another one is habits, those unconscious behaviors that we engage in. Probably, if you think about your day, I would say probably 2/3 of everything you do without even thinking about it, just out of habit. So habits can be really powerful. There's a category I call tricks of the mind, and it's just kind of interesting, weird things that our brains and our behavior do, how we anchor to certain numbers and things like that. Then there is the need to belong. We are social animals. Actually, there's research that shows that if we don't have enough connections to other people, it can literally kill us. So some really fascinating research about how social we really are. And then two more, instincts, how we react automatically to basically three things, food, sex, and danger. And then the last one is the desire for mastery, how we want to grow, we want to learn new things. We have this innate desire to learn new things, and that can be very motivating.
Okay, so you put me on the spot to choose the three powerhouses.
Yeah, I did.
I will admit I have not read your full book. So you got me there.
Okay.
So I'm going to take a shot at this. I'm going to play along with you.
Yes.
Okay, so my, I'd say, very informed guess is number one, the need to belong would be a powerhouse.
You are correct.
Okay. And these are in no particular order, just the top three. I would say the desire for mastery.
You got two out of three.
Okay, I cheated on that one. And the last one, I'm going to say the power of stories.
Ooh, listen. You sure?
Do I get a gold star?
You really get a, well, not only do you get a gold star, but.
An honorary PhD.
You do, yes. You have gained mastery.
All right. Okay, that's, perfect.
You're right. Those are the three powerhouses. Very good.
So I cheated a little bit in that you brought up the desire for mastery during the pre-interview, but I do know, I mean, I've read, you know, a lot of the big books that everybody talks about. So Influence and, you know, Made to Stick and some of these other big, Predictably Irrational is actually one of my favorites. But if you could talk about those three, I'd really appreciate it. Maybe we start with the desire for mastery. I think that's a great place to start.
Yeah. So, you know, if you think about, if you ever watch a baby or a toddler, you know, trying to learn how to do something, you know, learn to walk or a baby trying to crawl or anything, you if you just observe them for a minute or two, they're, you know, just so determined, you know, and they'll fail over and over, and it doesn't bother them at all. You know, they don't think of it as failure. They just have this drive to do this thing, whatever it is. And, you know, we're all born with that desire to be able to do something, to learn new skills, to grow, to keep going, to be a master of our environment at the moment. So it's what's called an intrinsic motivation, because we'll do it. It doesn't, you know, no one has to give us a reward. We're just doing it because we really want to do it. And if you can tap into that, yeah, people will do a lot of stuff because you've tapped into that desire. So there's three really important precursors, three things that have to be there if you want to stimulate the desire for mastery. And one is people have to have a feeling of autonomy, They have to feel like they have some power over how they learn or how they do this thing and when they do it. If they feel like they don't have any power at all, they won't keep going. So that's one, is autonomy. Another one is it has to be the right level of challenge. You know, if something is too easy, they're not going to stay motivated and keep going. But if it's too hard, then they're going to give up. So it's got to be, it has to be flexible enough that it can be the right amount of challenge for them at that moment. And then the third thing that keeps this desire for mastery going is feedback. And I don't mean feedback with praise. In fact, the research shows us that if you want people to keep motivated, you need to give them feedback about how they're doing without telling them they're doing a great job. This is the one that so many people, when I work with them, they say, what do you mean? I can't tell them they're doing a good job. And I'm like, right. Don't just tell them what they did with this that was correct, or just the fact, like if you're using a piece of software, if you're playing a game, you know, just the fact that it happens, right? The explosion occurs on the screen, or the file gets saved. I mean, that's feedback, right? You don't need to say, oh, great job, or give them 50 points or a gold star. Just the fact that they have some feedback that they are on the right track is all they need. So those three things really then amp up that desire for mastery. And people will do a lot in order to feel like they are growing and mastering a skill or a knowledge.
And can you think of an example of how you would apply this to a business, whether it's your own or someone else's? What is a great example of how the desire for mastery can help motivate people?
Well, for someone like me, right, because I do a lot of teaching. I have a lot of we help people learn. We have training courses. And one of the things that we experienced was that we could offer an individual course that someone would take and even give them, you know, a little certificate of completion. And that, you know, people were taking our courses. But what we then did was we bundled a bunch of them together. And instead of just taking courses, you now would earn a UX certificate, user experience certificate. And so it was a lot more work for them. I mean, there's six courses. So there's a lot of work. If they're going to get the certificate, they have to take an exam. It costs a lot more money. And it increased our sales of our online courses I don't actually have the exact numbers, but at least by a factor of 5 and perhaps as much as 10 times as much business when we bundled them together in the certificate. And a big part of that is because now I'm not just taking a course and learning something, but I am now going to master this field called UX. I'm going to take these courses, and when I'm done, I can really say, I have a UX certificate. I have passed the exam. I have learned this body of knowledge. And that's much more motivating. And the other thing that has changed since we did that is the percentage of people that complete the work versus just, you know, making the purchase, right? Mm-hmm. So 90% of the people who complete their certificate finish the certificate. And if you just sign, you know, for people who just take one of our courses, the figure is probably about 30 or 40% of the people actually complete. So I know it's much, and it's the same material. It's not a different course. It's the same course. But it's much more motivating when you know that at the end of it, you're going to be able to say, I have mastered this body of knowledge.
Well, I just want to give you a compliment here because I've heard from some people who sell courses online that their attrition rate is something like 95%.
Yeah.
So the fact that you're getting so many people to complete your courses, even on the low end, is fantastic. So you obviously are doing a lot of things right. So that sounds like it's successful for both you and for the people taking the courses. Now, I think that naturally lends itself to the power of stories because, you know, one thing that you say here in The Power of Stories is that if you can get a person to take a small action that's in conflict with their own perception of themselves, it could lead to a bigger change eventually. Can you talk a little bit about the power of stories?
Yeah, this is that idea of self stories that I mentioned, and it's so powerful. This comes from work. There's a guy named Timothy Wilson. He's a professor, and I was so thrilled to interview him on one of our podcast episodes because I've been a fan of his for so long. I love his books. He wrote a book called Redirect, and that's all about this idea of self stories. And he's done a lot of research, and he's reviewed the research that others have done. And this idea that we have these stories, and, you know, remember, almost everything I talk about, most of it's unconscious, right? Because we know that 90% of our mental activity is unconscious. So most people don't even realize that they have, that any of the things we're talking about in this, in our time together here are going on, including what we were saying about desire for mastery. But and that's especially true with the self stories. So we have these stories about who we are. The example I use in the book, and that I use when I give talks a lot, is a story from me. You remember those ads years ago for people who would buy a Microsoft product versus buy a Mac product, or, you know, buy a PC versus a Mac, and they had the nerdy PC guy and the hip Mac Apple person, you know?
Yep. Uh-huh.
Well, for many years, I was definitely, you know, the nerdy PC person. I mean, I was always used PC products, never owned anything by Apple. I'm pretty sure I had been known to say, I will never buy an Apple computer. Those words had come out of my mouth. So I had a self story that I was, you know, kind of a techie kind of person, not an arty kind of person. Uh-huh. And I didn't even realize that was an operating self story. And then at one point, I have two children, and they came to me and they said they wanted an iPod. And this is when the iPods had kind of first come out. And I remember thinking, oh, iPod, isn't that an Apple product, you know? So I wasn't inclined to buy one because, you know, I don't think I want to do that. But, you know, I love my kids. I like to spoil them. So I ended up buying them an Apple. So that's a small, right? I just took an action that's against a self story. That created, unbeknownst to me, cognitive dissonance is the term that's used. When you take an action that goes against something that you believe, and you may not even realize it. Now, it was a very small action, right? Because I wasn't buying it for me, and it wasn't really a computer. It was just an iPod. So it was a little. So it created a little pain, but not that bad, right? But mm-hmm. as soon as I took that action, I had, I call this the crack strategy, because it created a crack. My kids later on said, don't call it that.
I bet they did.
You don't know what that means, you know? I'm like, what? So anyway, but it created a crack in my persona, my self story, my self persona, because then what happened, again, this was all, I did not put this together till years later, because what happened next was, I think one of them wanted an iPhone, and I bought an iPhone, and then somebody wanted my son was going to college and he wanted a Mac laptop, and I bought an Apple computer.
Scary moment, no doubt.
And I never even realized what happened until it was years later. My husband walked into my home office, and he looked at me and he said, "When did this happen?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "This." And I looked around. You know, I was talking on my iPhone while I had my Mac laptop, while the Apple TV was on, while I was doing something on my iPad. I mean, I had purchased everything they make,
mm-hmm.
multiple copies of everything they made. And I had become totally, I mean, I owned Apple stock, you know, that, and it had been this, you know, it's kind of a slow transition, but a huge transition. And it was all because of one tiny little thing I just bought an iPod for my son, you know. So if you can get people, what Timothy Wilson talks about in his book is if you can get people to take one little action that goes against their existing self story, you can eventually do this huge turnaround that will last a very long time.
Yeah, in conversion rate optimization, we like to call those micro conversions, right?
Yeah,
getting
definitely.
People to take steps in a direction that's closer to where we want them to go, based on whatever it is we're doing, right?
So yeah, and then what you do is you get them to take one little step, and then you get them to take another little step, right? It's all these,
yep,
this combination, and that's exactly what you do. But what you may not realize you're doing is you're either building or changing a self story as you do that.
Right, exactly. Well, and everybody's resistant to anything that feels like sales, which, of course, if a business wants to make more money, that's what they have to do, right? Is get people to partially piggyback on existing behaviors people have, but also get them to change their own personal story and become part of your business universe. Now, Susan, you're just teeing these up for me because when you were talking about Apple, one thing that really stood out to me is one of my favorite all-time marketing stories, and that is about the iPod. And one of the ways that they were able to get so much success with the iPod is bundling a pair of really crappy but white headphones with it. And so I remember I didn't go to UCLA, but a friend of mine did, being on University of California, Los Angeles's campus, maybe the year after the iPod first came out, and seeing 8 out of 10 people with headphones in wearing white headphones.
White wires coming out of their head, right?
Right. So I think this is a perfect segue into the need to belong and how that can be a really powerful motivation to play on.
Yeah, it is so strong. You know, there's some new research out, came out just at the beginning of 2016, which shows that there's an inverse relationship, inverse correlation between how many social connections you have, you know, and this can be friends or family, but just social ties, good social ties you have, is an inverse correlation with incidence of chronic diseases like diabetes, heart disease, cancer. It really, I mean, it affects our biology, not just our psychology. There's been known for a couple of years about what's called failure to thrive syndrome, where babies, if they don't have enough connection with another person, because there's been some orphanages that they were able to study, because obviously they're not going to do a controlled experiment like this, but where babies who they had plenty of food and they you know, they were in a safe and healthy environment, except they had no social connection. And a third of those babies, another third of them had physical and mental and emotional disabilities. So and when research was done on more research was done, it was found that their immune systems shut down so we know that we have to have social connection, and we will do amazing things to feel that we are part of a group and part of a tribe. It's just very strongly built into us. And so when you if you want people to take action, they need to feel that they're part of a group. And there's so many ways. You know, Gregory Walton did this great research where he used nouns rather than verbs. So, we're talking right here on the eve of our presidential election. He called people up before an election and asked them, he phrased it one of two ways. He would say, how likely is it that you're going to vote in the election tomorrow, or how likely is it that you're going to be a voter? He changed the wording, and 11% more people voted if he used the phrase, what do you think, to vote?
Be a voter.
Be a voter, yeah, because it invokes this group identity. So it, and I mean, you probably know this with, I'm sure you've experimented with, you know, conversion optimization on, you know, how you label things. I know I've had a couple of clients where we've changed the button name instead of, you know, donate now, we've changed it to be a donor or be a member or all kinds of variations we've tested. And, you know, more people give money. And it's because you've invoked this group identity. So we really want to be part of a group.
Yeah, indeed. We definitely do. And, one thing I would say about testing is I think usually know what's going to work reasonably well, but we're still often surprised at what works and what doesn't work.
You
just never really know given whoever you're in front of. And
well, that's that audience and that situation.
Exactly.
And, you know, everything else that's on that page, right?
Yeah, we wish there was something hard and fast because it would make our jobs a lot easier, but there's not. So, well, with that said, Susan, we are to the point in the show where I'm going to ask you three questions that I ask of every guest.
Okay.
And the first is, what is the biggest mistake people make in learning about their customers?
I think the biggest mistake that people make in learning about their customers is that they assume that people are, I'm going to say that they assume that people are rational.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that?
That, you know, you give people the right information at the right time, they'll make the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
And that there, you know, that there, it's a logical, you know, people are logical. People are going to listen. They're going to pay attention. And that's not the way people are at all.
So with that information, what is the one thing everyone can do today to learn more about their buyers?
Well, you know, I'm going to be biased, right? Because I'm a psychologist. So I'm going to say, I think you need to understand some of these basic principles about humans.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, obviously you want to learn about the particular humans you're trying to sell to. And for instance, you know, we were talking about the seven drivers of motivation, right? Well, which of these are going to be most motivating for your particular audience in your particular situation? But I think in general, you got to know about people.
Yeah. So one way, of course, that people could do that is to read your book, How to Get People to Do Stuff, Master the Art and Science of Persuasion and Motivation, which goes into more detail about what we talked about today. Is there another book that you recommend besides your own?
Yeah, I have so many. I'm turning around and looking at my whole bookshelf. You know, I'm going to say it's not an easy read. So I got to warn people about that. But I love this book. Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. Do you know that book?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've written an article based on that book.
Yeah. I just love that book. There's so much in there. I mean, you could study that book for a year.
Well, he did win a Nobel Prize based on the research in that book.
So we would hope it would have some depth, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay, very cool. Well, thank you for that recommendation. And if they want to connect with you, where can people listening to this get a hold of you? What's the best way?
Probably just email me, Susan at theteamw.com. And that's our website also, theteamw.com, theteamw.com.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for being here, Susan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.